This podcast is brought to you by Nordic Business Forum, the greatest business show on earth. I've attended Nordic Business Forum in Finland for the last 3 years, and one of my favorite takeaways came in 2013 when Vijay Govindarajan introduced me to his three-box strategy model. So box number one is about managing the present, box number two about selectively abandoning the past, and box number three about creating the future. I love the model and I've been using it ever since. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. The tickets for the Nordic Business Forum Sweden in January 2017 are now available. Go to nbforum.com/Sweden to get yours. Welcome to another episode of Boss Level. Today's topic is product management and lean startup. My guest is Melissa Perry. When I asked around for tips on who to interview while in New York, her name came up frequently. I've met her at several conferences and I knew her to be an expert on product management. And I was sure that we'd have a fun chat, so I reached out and she agreed to sit down for an interview. We talk about how to get from business requirements, which often aren't really requirements at all, to validated learning. We discuss validation, experiments, user research, a weekly cadence, and how top management and product management should work together. From a technical standpoint, this interview was not easy. It was recorded at the Reactor office in New York, and my initial plan was to record this in the corner office, and I'd done all the setup beforehand, but when I started listening to the room through my headphones, I realized that the sound of traffic was going to be audible. And I did not anticipate that to be the case on the 10th floor of an office building in Midtown Manhattan. But I guess that only goes to show how much I have to learn about New York. But anyway, by this time, Melissa had already arrived. I asked her if she'd be okay with waiting a little while I set up all the gear in a meeting room in the middle of the building. Well, she obliged, and it was maybe a 10-minute operation, so not that bad. And we then quickly get started on the interview in the new room, and the echo in the room is horrible. Horrible. Way worse than the traffic would have been in the corner office. I try to ignore it for a while, but I just can't. So I stop the interview, I apologize profusely, and go look for a meeting room that wouldn't have such a horrible echo. And none to be found. So we end up moving the gear back to the original corner office. All I can really say at this point is thank you, Melissa, for your patience. But then again, on the plus side, this was a great excuse for me to buy more audio plugins that I could use to get rid of the loudest honks and sirens. However, I think this episode was worth all the hassle, so I hope you like it.
I am a product management consultant and trainer. So I come into companies and help teams learn how to do better product management and also coach their product managers on how to get better at their craft. So things that I really concentrate on is how to take a leadership role and harness a team around a goal, around trying to make the product better for your customers, discovering user problems, and also trying to get the company to understand too what a nice flow-based product management system works for. So how do we actually incorporate the practices of validating our features with our users before we set out to build them? So trying to harness the company around that, change our product development processes, and provide support for them along the way.
If there are listeners who are not familiar with Lean Startup at all, like, can you like speak a little about the history of it? Where does it come from?
Yeah. So Lean Startup originally comes from stuff written by Steve Blank. So that idea of getting out of the building and talking to your users. And then Eric Ries popularized the movement in his book, Lean Startup. And that's where it really took off. Then everybody was like, wow, this is revolutionary, because he made it in a way that people could digest. But validating customers, validating with customers has been around for quite a while. And Steve Blank really promoted, like, for enterprises, getting out of the building and going to talk to your users, you know, watching what they do. And if you are familiar with actually Toyota Lean, that might sound really familiar as well, with walking the Gemba, going to see what's happening, seeing what's, you know, go out and see. So it's that kind of concept applied to users is what Lean Startup is really about.
And what do you think? Why was Lean Startup necessary? I mean, like you said, it kind of sounds like common sense to talk to your customers. So what was happening in product management before that?
Yeah, so it really does sound like common sense. And it's funny because every time I give a talk on this, I kind of second guess myself and go, isn't this just common sense? Like, yeah. Are people going to be like, why are you talking about that? Of course we know that. And it's not. So what happens though in companies is when we come up with what to build for our customers, we're so trapped in our own heads and we get married to the first idea that we come up with that we don't go out and prove that it's worth building. We just set out to building it. So product management historically hasn't really been this validation role with users. When I learned how to do product management too, which was almost 10 years ago now, I was taught like you go to the business users inside your company, you write down the requirements that they wanted, you go back to your computer and you start making specs. We also were a combined UX designer and product manager, so I'd immediately go into Photoshop, make high fidelity mockups, and then ship that off to the developers. And I barely ever spoke to the developers. Like that never happened. I just spec'd everything, managed the backlog. And I don't even think we had the backlog at the time. It was just specs.
Yeah.
And put it out, but we never actually tested anything. We would test it in QA to make sure it worked, but we wouldn't really test it with users. So that's traditionally what product management has been, because if you read the description too of what people look for, even Google had this on their website, and I used to use it as an example of how not to advertise for a product manager for the longest time, and they recently changed it. But it's all focused on gathering business requirements and understanding technical implications rather than building things that users want.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the big shift that's going on and that's happening is going from like gathering requirements to actual like customer validation.
Exactly, because we say they're requirements for business, right? But are they really requirements for our customers? No, they're what we think off the top of our head of what we need, but we don't actually validate those things with customers. So what we're seeing right now is a shift from coming up with everything internally and treating that as a truth of what is needed, to looking outside of our company at our users and really understanding what their requirements are, what their needs are, and providing the right solutions for that.
So, but isn't it so that the business requirements, they're supposed to be like, they're derived from the like what customers want?
You would think so, but in my experience, it's what we think customers want rather than what customers want, right? So I'll give you an example. This always happens in B2B companies. I worked at a B2B company too. And by the time a request came down the line for product management, we would be sitting there and go, why do we want to build this? So you trace it back up the line and the stakeholders were salespeople, right? So in B2B companies, the stakeholders are always salespeople. And the salespeople would go, well, I talk to these clients every single day and they're telling me they want X, Y, and Z feature, right? So we have to build it. And we used to just build those things. But when you actually start measuring with your customers, if that's what they want, it turns out it's not, because what the salesperson interpreted as what they want is not really what solved their problem. It's just that they're coming down with feature requests. So a lot of times when we only go to stakeholders for business requirements, we get feature requests of their interpretation of what the best solution is. And sometimes too, it's customers saying, I want this solution rather than I have this problem. You guys are the experts. Go try to solve it for me. So for example, at one of those B2B companies too, this is like my favorite example. We heard from everybody and we put it, you know, all the customers said it too. All the stakeholders said it. We need this forecasting mechanism. We need this forecasting feature. And when we finally set up to do it, and everybody was going crazy about this, and they're like, it's on our Q3 roadmap and we haven't hit our goals yet and it's Q4 and we have to build it. So it was a huge push to build it. We start speccing it out. And I said, I really need to do user research on this and understand what they mean when they say forecast feature. So after a lot of fighting, they let me go talk. And I was the head UX person here too. So, and I had a fight for that. But after a lot of fighting, I talked to the customer about it and he was kind of explaining what the requirements were. It was coming out of his mouth. But then I asked him to open up the spreadsheet he was currently using and show me how he was doing it manually. And it was totally different than the requirements. And it turns out like that what he really, really wanted and really needed was basically predicting the future. And what we were setting out to give him was something that he already had. And he was like, no, that's what I have. I don't need this thing. But those were the requirements passed down to us by the salespeople. So they didn't really understand the nuances of his problem and what his goals were. They just heard what he was asking for.
Okay. Sounds reasonable that it would make more sense to actually build something that the customer actually wants. So how do we get to that? How can we do this differently?
Yeah. We have to start by first interviewing customers, first talking to them, right? It's like the most basic thing, but that's step one. So a lot of companies don't actually have standard user research practices in them. And when I go to them and I ask them, okay, like when was the last time you talked to a customer as a product manager? They go, years. Yeah. You know, I talked to one at an event like 3 years ago. I talked to my mom.
And I think they get feedback from their customer service channels,
yeah.
But that's already been like interpreted and it's been aggregated and they get a report. And it's like, it's very far from like what the customer actually said.
And it's always about complaints too. It's never about what could be possible in the future either. And that's something that we want to balance. We don't want to always be plugging holes. We want to make sure that our products are good, but we also have to do user research to figure out where could we possibly go? How could we innovate on this? What are gaps in the market that we could actually fill based on the needs of our customer? And if you're just getting customer service complaints, you're not hearing those things. Yeah. So I think like the first step is just implementing user research practices and like a feedback loop for your customers to actually tell you, you know, face to face or in person or on the phone for like 30 minutes, what it is they need, what their biggest problems are, and how they react to things that you have already given them and shown them.
And when you say user research, it sounds to me like a big thing, but you're probably not like,
no.
You're talking about something lightweight.
Yeah, super lightweight. It doesn't have to be. So this is a problem too. A lot of companies, when they do user research, they kick it off as a big project and they spend like 3 weeks on it before they start a project doing user research. If you make that continuous and you just have people lined up every week, you can spend like a few hours doing user research every week and you don't have to take those 3 weeks of not developing anything. It should be so ingrained in your practices that it's something that you can, you know, harness every single time you release something and you have this continuous loop. It's not something that we just do once and forget about it because your customers have tons of feedback. You change up the questions of what you ask them each week based on, you know, the stage of your product and where you are in development cycle, but you don't just front load that. Also, if you front load that and you are working, you know, in a waterfall way or big project based way, from what I've seen is you'll go out and do the user research. And then 6 months later, when you actually release your product, the market changed, right? Like things change, customer doesn't want it anymore, situations change, and you don't want to fall into that trap. So it's really important to do it continuously. And you don't have to talk to many people. In my experience, I can talk to maybe like 7 people for 30 minutes and get a good gist of, you know, where I should place my bets on what to build. Nothing comes back. It's hard sometimes to get feedback that's super definitive about, you know, no customer is going to be like, this is exactly what you should do. And I don't think anybody should expect that. Sometimes it happens. That's nice. But yeah. Most of the time it doesn't. But it at least just narrows down your options and you figure out where to start. And I think that's the most important thing.
Okay. So what happens next? What happens after you've been talking to your customers or you are talking to your customers on a weekly basis?
So the way that I like to work is more of an experiment-driven product management approach. So until we figure out for sure, like this is what we should be building, we're going to test it first, which is coming from like lean startup background, mm-hmm. Lean startup and agile. It's a huge combination of lean startup, agile, design thinking. It's taking all those principles and just putting it into practice.
Yep.
And what we do is we say, okay, we uncovered what the customer problem is. Let's make a hypothesis about how we can solve it. And let's try to test it in a small way with the user to make sure that we're on the right track or to learn more about it if we're at that stage. So before you know for certain that this is the right path to go down or this is the right solution, we have to test it and we have to get feedback that we're going in the right direction. So all the tests are designed to increase your chances of having a successful bet when you build like the whole feature.
So first you talk to the customers, you get some insights from that, and then based on that feedback, you create an experiment, which is like you actually might write some code, but it's still a very like lightweight version of what you're actually going for.
Yep. So right now I have the teams kind of capping experiments at a week, so we won't spend more than a week on an experiment. And it's also to kind of just drive focus and scope. What happens is if you don't cap it at a week, it's like 8 weeks later, hey, where's that experiment? So we're trying that. And it's not that we won't be flexible. If something really good comes up or we realize we have to take an investment somewhere, stretch it to 2 weeks. We have that conversation. We make sure, though, that if we're going to invest more time, it's something that's a little bit more known. It's like it's a good experiment to run, and it's worth that time because we're going to get really good learnings back from it. But we do short, you know, very collaborative process to run these experiments, and we plan on Monday and launch on Friday.
What I think is often the case is that it's really hard to figure out things that you can do within a week, that you can actually implement within a week and actually get data out of in a week.
Yeah. So one of the most successful small experiments too, that we ran was purely based on, so there was this company that I was working for. It's an e-commerce company, and it's a subscription based. So we saw a lot of people were leaving on the delivery step of the address. So we're looking at our data. We're like, people are bailing on this delivery step. And we did two things. One experiment was to implement something called Qualaroo, which is a little pop-up on the bottom of the screen. And when you move your mouse towards like the back button, it pops up and it says, what's stopping you from signing up today? And honestly, my developer came up with this idea. Fantastic idea. I was super skeptical though. I was like, nobody's going to take the time to actually type in there. Maybe we should give him multiple choice. And he was like, let's do this first and then we can iterate on it. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Like, let's just launch it and see what happens. And we got like 500 responses in a week on it. I was like, whoa, this is insane. Yeah. And it was great stuff. And, you know, they were telling us, you know, you're not showing us the product. I need more information. The delivery date I'm choosing is not available, but like really rich information on there. So we used that, and then we designed another experiment to figure out what were some of the most, if we could try to solve that problem for them in that moment. So what we did was we put links on that step that just said like, you know, here's a link to more information about the product and more FAQs and delivery things and answer like their top three pressing problems. And we wanted to see how often people clicked on that so that we could really see that they're looking for more information. And we wanted to see if it solved their problem. And it increased the conversion rate that we're looking at a little bit, not fantastically. It was a pretty poor solution implementation, but we did learn like overwhelmingly people had this one top question. So that kind of informed our next strategy of just showing the product in a better light on the site. So we're going back to like the homepage. We're trying to really showcase the product, give people more information about it. But that took like a week and a half to run. And that kind of informed our whole strategy for what we're doing now.
I love with this whole approach is like, one of the things that I love about it is that instead of talking about opinions and like, I think that this is what's happening and someone else might have a different opinion, you can actually get some real data and even like small sets of like data, like based on what happens on a website or what people like write in a like a text box, it's still better than just talking about opinions.
Yeah, definitely. And it was all opinions before this. You know, at this company, we were doing road mapping for Q1, and it was just all opinions about what's going to move the needle rather than solid evidence about what will get us to our goal. And doing stuff like this makes it really clear about like what we should be doing next, what should be on the roadmap, what shouldn't be on the roadmap, because we have data from users in the context of them signing up and what our goal relates to, where it says like, I need this stuff. Like, can you go back and fix this stuff? So it's easier to make arguments about why we should be doing the things we're doing.
So what are your gripes about product management at the moment? Like what are the things that you just wish that like everyone will get?
Yeah. So I guess one of the biggest issues is dealing with stakeholders. I hear this from everybody. How do I deal with stakeholders? Because you have to tell them no a lot, and they don't want to hear no for an answer. It's a tricky one. So a lot of stakeholders have, you know, things on their plate that they have to get done and accomplish, and they need development resources for it. So they'll come to the product managers and they'll be like, you have to build this for us right now. And if you say no, because you're working on other stuff, they kind of freak out. And I think I would love stakeholders to realize, like, yes, your things are important, but we have value prioritized across a company and we want to help you meet your goals, but we have to focus on the big picture of what the company needs to get there. It's not that I don't want to build your things. It's just that it's not the most strategic move to do right now. So I think stakeholders are always an issue. I hear from like so many product managers, how do I deal with these stakeholders? How do I deal, especially salespeople too? The salespeople are giving me a laundry list of things we have to build for our customers. And they're not letting me actually go talk to the customers and figure out what they want. And, you know, they're just spitting out feature requests to me and then putting them in contracts and making them sign it. So we have to deliver it or we'll get sued. It's like a terrible way of working. I just wish people would understand that to do effective product management, you have to take the time to talk to your customers and validate those things before you can put it on any roadmap. It's not just about spitting out features, because at a certain point, your product becomes so complex, so feature heavy, and that's not a good thing anymore. Like, it's not good to have 7,000 features. It's better to have 5 features that work really, really well and kill the competition because you spent the time developing them and making sure they were awesome than it is to have like 300 features that don't work or are kind of broken that you can't maintain.
Are you ever bothered by the fact that we very seldom get rid of features?
Oh, yeah. That's my biggest issue. I always ask people when I do my workshop on minimum viable products, like, when was the last time you killed a feature? And nobody raises their hands ever. I think one person raised their hand once and everybody was like, wow. And that was in Israel. But nobody ever raises their hands. And it's because they laugh, actually. That would be nice, killing a feature. And I think partly it's due because we don't actually measure features very often of their success and how they're doing. So that definitely plays a role in it. We don't know how our features are doing, so we can't kill them if we don't measure them and have goals for each one. Two, it's because there's this one of these cognitive biases, which is called the loss aversion bias and the sunk cost bias. It's that, well, we spent all this time building it. You can't just take it away. Somebody will use it eventually, right? And I've built so many features in the past like that. Like, I think every product manager has. And you're like, well, nobody's using it. So one day they will, you know? And that, I love, this is one of my favorite justifications of that too. It's like, well, the customers just don't understand yet that they have to use this. And you're like, no, but it's been there for 2 years. When are they going to learn? Like, when are they going to need it? You're like, oh, maybe they'll need it someday. And you're like, haven't needed it in 2 years. So, but yeah, we never take things away. And it's that fear that people go, oh, where did it go? In case they are using it, which means you have no metrics showing if people are using it or not. And also that we just wasted time. And I think that's why experimenting is so important too, because you don't want to get at that point where you have to say, oh, we have to kill this feature, but we spent 6 months building it. But nobody's using it. When you experiment, you avoid those conversations.
Yeah, but I mean, still, even if you do that, it's still possible that you end up killing features because, like, the situation changes. You could just end up in a situation where you have a feature and no one is using it, even though 6 months ago it was really important.
Yeah, yeah. When the market changes and things will pop up, and I think you have to audit your features all the time. So that, I think that is really important too, the making sure you're responding to market changes.
So actually, when I think about all the things that you've been saying about like what's under the like umbrella of product management, what do you think are qualities that a good product manager has?
I think a relentless drive to figure out what user problems are always really gets me for product managers. When I see a good product manager, and it was it's actually pretty relevant because a couple people have reached out to me. I'm part of like this women's group, which is really awesome, called Dreamers and Doers. And we always post like offers on there or asks. And I've seen like a couple over the last couple of days that were, oh, I'm interviewing for a product management position. I haven't been a product manager before. Can somebody, you know, help me out with it? And I was like, sure. So I did that and I did one for a friend and then we just hired a product manager at my client. So I feel like I've done all these interviews lately. But I can tell instantly when I start talking to these people if they're going to make a good product manager or not. And to me, it's their way of thinking. And there's a few qualities. And one of them is they can put themselves in their user's shoes and talk about the needs from a user perspective. Like everything is in context of the user when they talk about feature decisions and goals and needs. And you can see they have really deep empathy for them. One of the ladies I talked to built a site for accessible locations around the country, right? So for people who are handicapped and needed help getting around. And when you talk to her about, you know, the users of it, she was like, well, imagine you're going like down the street in a wheelchair and you can't get over the curb. Like, how would you know that? Or you're trying to go into this restaurant and it's got stairs and you didn't know that before you booked a table there. So everything she talked about was like from a user's perspective of these people being in there. And she's, you could see like when you asked her about how she made feature decisions, that was really taken into account. It all started there. Then she understood what the business value was for it too. So like one of her biggest goal on the website was to get people to write reviews of locations because it was a social website. So the more reviews they had, the more people would come there and find value from it. So everything that she did was strategized around trying to get people to write more reviews. So it was a more robust website, but it was totally from the user's perspective. If we have more reviews, the user gets more value. Then they're going to come back and keep looking at our website. So she positions everything that way. But it was this drive to satisfy the user, but also this concentration on one metric that really mattered and moved the needle, and prioritizing things in that way. And when I see people take that logical approach to, okay, what's the actual problem we're solving here? Well, you know, what's the data behind it? What's the information that I have? Okay, let me figure out which first step to take to uncover like where we go. I think that's really important. Like a logical way of thinking in that order that does focus on those two values, balancing business with balancing customer.
And a lot of the things that you're talking about requires a really like systematic approach. It's mm-hmm. it's not just like ad hoc. It's really like rigorous. Like
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really is a systematic process too. It's when you think like, you know, a product manager, you're analyzing everything just like you were a scientist. I use something called the Toyota Kata method to set up like my experimentation, in a product thing. And I wrote a post on it called Product Kata. But it was just, when I found like the Toyota Kata, I realized it just matched the way I thought. And what it is it's to train people to have that logical process. So you like start off by going, what's my goal? What am I trying to achieve here? What's my current challenge? So like, for the first one, it's where am I? So where am I right now? What's the state of things? Second one is, what's my current challenge? So what's standing in my way? What's the obstacle? So that could be the customer problem you're trying to solve. That could be, you know, technical implications. It could be just, we're not moving fast enough. It could be anything, but what is the challenge? What's something I can do to get rid of that challenge? How will I know that I got rid of it? Like what's the measure of success and what did we learn from it? And you incorporate that and you keep cycling it through. And I think good product managers take that very systematic approach, whether they write it out or whether they know they're doing it or not. It's just like, that's how they're wired to think.
Yeah. So how technical do you feel that a product manager should be?
I don't think very technical. Technical enough to have a conversation with a developer about the cost of implementing things. I was a developer for a year. So when I first transitioned back into product management, I thought I wanted to be a developer. Then I was like, no, definitely not. It really wasn't for me. I was like the worst developer. But I had like, you know, a weird know-how of how to do things. So when I transitioned back to being a product manager, I was actually like over-involved in the development aspects of it. And it was driving my developers nuts because I was like, well, I really like to do this, but I think it's impossible. I think it's going to take a long time. And they were like, no, Melissa, for a good developer, that'll take a day. <You know? laughs> And it's because I couldn't do it that I was like, oh, I'm not going to like pitch these solutions to people. So I actually found it to be good because I could have a conversation with the developers about it, but bad because it held me back from my own technical limitations. So I feel like if you understand how products get built, what the development process is, why certain things take longer than others, that's like plenty of time to have a conversation. Like I can go up to my developers and be like, well, I want to launch this in a week. How possible is that? And then they'll go, well, you know, we're going to have to do this kind of work on the back end. The database isn't set up for this right now. You know, we are using a new system on the front end. So it's all like going to contribute into it. So they've explain it in layman's terms. And when I don't understand something, I'm like, I don't know what that means. So go back. And they usually, you know, I think developers who are great communicators, they don't launch in the technical terms. Like they'll say it enough where I understand which pieces of components they're talking about, but they don't explain it to me like, you know, I'm one of them and I know exactly like what they're talking about. They just overview, say like what their process is going, and that's enough for me to understand.
Did we miss any topics? Anything that you feel that we should have talked about but we just didn't get to?
I think maybe the one thing that I was thinking about is like how does management, like the top C-level executives, actually affect product management?
That's a great question. How does top management affect product management?
So it plays a huge role in product management. And ideally, I can go into any team and be like, this is how you work as a product manager and developer. And the teams I have done this with from the bottom, they like eat it up. They're like, I love this way of working. It's fantastic. And it always gets screwed up by management. Because typically what happens is the product managers aren't even coming up with their own ideas of what to build. They're being handed the ideas from management, who sets a roadmap without a lot of input from the teams on what they can accomplish. So managers will set this roadmap and just kind of hand it off to junior product managers or even mid-level product managers too, and then just say, go build it. And a lot of validation goes into these roadmaps either. So management is up here having like a very top-down approach. Whereas when we do great validation with our product management, it has to be a bottom-up approach. We have to do that research to inform what the product roadmap should be. And we're not doing that in most companies that I see right now. Like we make them very rigid, like commitments to features. And we tell the teams, nope, you got to go do this, you know, next quarter. Teams go, okay, I got to do it. Like this is what my paycheck is relying on. And then they go do it. But it's not necessarily the best things that we validate. So management needs to take a step back and ask the teams, like, what is your roadmap? What are the things that you can accomplish? But in order to do that too, they need to set clear goals. And they have to say, you know what, this team over here, you're responsible for increasing our retention of our customers by 20%, you know, next year. How are you going to do that? And let the team figure out what are the best bets to take based on what they're hearing from the customers. And when you flip the script like that, that empowers a team to make decisions. So people get really excited because they're not just handed, you know, stuff to build going, I had no input in this. They just start going, oh, I actually have control over this and I can make informed decisions. They don't feel like they have their hands tied to like a burning wagon. So I think it's really important for management to understand that. And that has been the biggest barrier I've had to implementing these approaches in companies. I can come in, I can sit with product managers, I can train them like crazy. They can be the best product managers ever, and they will never be effective in a company that has management deciding roadmaps without any input from customers and then dictating what they should be to those product managers.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your time. It was a really fun chat.
No problem. It's great.
You can read more about Melissa's work at melissaperry.com. You can also follow her on Twitter. She's @LizzieJean. And all the links are in the show notes. Melissa also mentioned Toyota Kata, and if you're interested in learning more about that, you might want to check out episode number 11 of Boss Level, which is titled Hawk on Force and the Toyota Kata Meta Process. Remember, sharing is caring, and reviews on iTunes are highly appreciated. Tune in again in 2 weeks. Bye.